Today being the 15th day of the 12th month, we are commemorating the Festival of Purim, which is a non-God-ordained but biblical festival talked about in the Book of Esther that is made to remember Yahweh's mercy on his people and his remembrance of his promises and covenants that he has extended throughout the ages. There is a written study on a lot of the genealogical happenings that come to fruition in the Book of Esther that can be found at GoshenHomesteads.com on the subject. And this will kind of dovetail into it and mention some things that are not talked about as much and some of the further reaching applications to that genealogy and what it says more in the Christian era. Starting in Esther chapter 1, we're going to quickly see some things that, unless you have background information on, you probably won't understand or make some connections to. It says, "Now it came to pass in the days of Ahasuerus," this is Ahasuerus, "which reigned from India even unto Ethiopia, over 127 provinces, that in those days when the king Ahasuerus sat on the throne of his kingdom, which was in Shushan, the palace." Okay. Ahasuerus, which is also known as Xerxes in regular secular history, is the king that sat on the throne. He's also one of the kings that sat on the throne in Daniel chapter 9. And I guess that connection is not as commonly known, but this would mean that Daniel and Mordecai were contemporaries in the palace, and a lot of this could have been going on right while Daniel was there being a governor. So there are two prominent Israelite people being mentioned here in Ahasuerus's palace. Daniel chapter 9, 1 says, "In the first year of Darius, the son of Ahasuerus, of the seed of the Medes, which was made king over the realm of the Chaldeans." The Chaldeans are the Babylonian people. We see here that Darius is the son of Ahasuerus. So whether Daniel and Mordecai and Esther overlapped or not, or is not absolutely known, but the possibilities are there that while Darius was the son of Ahasuerus, that Esther could have possibly been on the throne as queen up until that point. We're not exactly sure how that all worked, and we're not told of any children that were had between Ahasuerus and Esther either, but there's a pretty interesting connection. It says here that Darius, the son of Ahasuerus, was of the seed of the Medes. And so one of the questions should arise is, you know, who is the Medes? And who is the king that's sitting on the throne? We're going to go to what is referred to as the Table of Nations, which is in the book of Genesis, which gives us the Adamic line of people that are the progenitors of the Adamites that are on the earth today. First in 10:1, we see that Noah had three sons. This should be common knowledge: Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Japheth, it says, had, and two, Gomer, Magog, Madai, Javan, Tubal, Meshech, and Tiras. Well, Madai, or Madai, depending on how you pronounce it, nobody's quite sure about that, would be the son that we get the word Median from. A Median is a Madaiite, or something of that nature. So he would be the third-born son of Japheth. Now, Japheth and Shem have a connection. Those two people were blessed while Ham well, not all of his progeny, much of Ham's progeny was uncursed, but one specific son would have been cursed. Does anybody remember which son that is? Emma?
Cain.
Canaan. And not to be confused with Cain, as in Cain and Abel, but Canaan. Canaan was the son of Ham, which was brought into the world through what is referred to as a possible incest or a unlawful adulteration. We won't call it a marriage, but relationship, which seems to have happened between Noah's wife, or maybe even Ham's mother, unfortunately, which seems, according to the Bible in Leviticus chapter 18, to have been a common thing among the Canaanites, that Yahweh warns Israel not to do as the practices of the Canaanites, and those that is among the listed things. So we have a group of people that are perfectly fine for what we'll say breeding stock, and then we have a group of people that are not good for breeding stock. Canaan was selected out, which you can go and read previously in Genesis 9, where verse 22 says, Ham, the father of Canaan, saw the nakedness of his father and told his two brethren without. Shem, Ham, and Japheth took a garment and laid it upon both of their shoulders and went backwards and covered the nakedness of their father, and their faces were backwards, and they saw not their father's nakedness. When Noah awoke from his wine and knew what his younger son had done unto him, he had said, Cursed be Canaan, a servant of servants shall he be unto his brethren. And he said, Blessed be Yahweh, the God of Shem. Canaan shall be his servant. God shall enlarge Japheth, and he will dwell in the tents of Shem. Canaan shall be his servant. So there's a blessing and a curse being offered here as early back as Genesis chapter 9, which we know by reading the book of Genesis, which can be found in the document that I had mentioned. This curse was passed down, seemingly, either in a written form or from mouth, oral tradition, father to son, so much that Abraham did not want Isaac to marry of the daughters of Canaan, and told Eliezer to go and get one of his own children, or one of his own kinsmen, child of his own people, for marrying. And then he also, it is also mentioned that Rebekah says that if Jacob would do like Esau had done and marry a Canaanite or a Hittite woman, which is another type of Canaanite, then her life would be worthless. It would be forfeit. It would be like it didn't exist. There would be no good use for her life. All of her children would have polluted their genes. They would have done wrong. Interestingly enough, if you were to continue to follow Esau's genealogy, when Esau heard this, it says in the book of Genesis, it says, when he heard that, he went and took himself a wife from the daughters of Ishmael and married them in order to please his parents. So he, now seeing one of the reasons why his birthright was despised, or we seeing how his birthright was despised in his eyes, was because he was willing to fornicate and pollute his seed with the Canaanites that God had previously cursed and has been known not to be permissible for God's people to breed with, to make children with. And Esau despised his birthright. He despised who he was. The right of his birth was that he was one of Yahweh's people, chosen through Abraham, chosen through Isaac, and he was an heir of the promise, just like Jacob was. Even though Rebekah received the promise while the children were in the womb, and the prophecy that the elder would serve the younger, and that was known that Jacob would do that, the most exciting part about the story of Jacob and Esau, where many people would think that there is a wickedness in Jacob for wanting that birthright, for wanting that to be his, there's actually more of the talk of the previous Bible study we had in Genesis chapter 15, where Yahweh comes to Abraham and says, "I am your shield and your exceedingly great reward," when the word of Yahweh came to him and said that. And Jacob wanted that great reward so bad that he knew his brother, who was a fornicator with Canaanite women, did not want his birthright nearly as much as Jacob apparently did, who didn't marry anybody yet at this point. But that he was willing to pursue his brother to receive it. And while that seems like a wicked or bad thing to not give your brother food, one of the things that has to be remembered is that when Yahweh makes a promise to his people, he will fulfill his promise. This is why we're told in Hebrews chapter 11 that Abraham was willing to sacrifice his son Isaac upon the altar, because he knew that Yahweh spoke to him and said, "In Isaac shalt thy seed be called." So he knew that no matter what anyone did to Isaac, Isaac was going to be the father of Abraham's seed to come and the heirs. And he trusted, Hebrews tells us, even in the resurrection of the dead, that Yahweh would bring this thing about that he promised. So likewise, Esau, if he trusted in his birthright, in the exceedingly great reward of Yahweh, he would have known that he could not die yet. He would have trusted that he would not starve to death. He would have trusted that because he was the child of the promise, he was going to be able to have the ability to receive that promise. You understand? But he didn't. He despised his birthright. And this is shown to us by him married into an accursed lineage. And it showed to us by his lack of faith that he would no longer worry about whether he's going to live or die, but rather he dwelled on his flesh, that he would perish. So, just from the first part of Esther, there's a long history that we've gone into, which has even carried over into Genesis, taking us back. We know that the Medians were descended from Japheth's third son, Madai, and that Darius was the son of Esther's husband. We don't know for sure, but it's a possibility that Darius could have been. I don't know if we know his genealogy or not. It's obvious that he had a problem with paganism even in his day, though. So there's some background information for us just to think about at that point. So in Esther 1, going back into 3, it says, "The third year of his reign, he made a feast," or an appointed time, a moed. Most likely, the moeds of the Medes and Persians were the same as those of the Israelites. An appointed time was appointed by the Genesis calendar, as found in chapter 1, according to the sun, moon, and stars, which is how Yahweh tells feasts, and how most pagan nations even reckon their gods' feasts are, but not all. "He made it unto all of his princes and his servants, the power of Persia and Media, the nobles and the princes of the province, being before him. When he showed the riches of his glorious kingdom and the honor of his excellent majesty, many days, even 180 days, now that's a pretty long festival. When these days were expired, the king made a feast unto all the people that were present in Shushan, the palace, both unto the great and the small, 7 days, in the court of the garden of the king's palace. where there were white, green, and blue hangings, fastened with cords of fine linen, purple, silver rings, and pillars of marble. The beds were of gold and silver upon the pavement of red and blue and white and black marble. And they gave them drink in vessels of gold, the vessels being diverse one from another, and royal wine in abundance according to the state of the king. And the drinking was according to the law. This isn't talking about the law of God, but the king's law. None did compel, for so the king had appointed to all the officers of his house, that they should do according to every man's pleasure. Also Vashti the queen made a feast for the women in the royal house which belonged to King Ahasuerus. On the seventh day, when the heart of the king was merry with wine, he commanded Mehuman, Biztha, Harbona, Bigtha, Abigatha, Zethar, Carcass, the seven chamberlains that served in the presence of Ahasuerus the king, to bring Vashti the queen before the king with the crown royal, to show the people and the princes her beauty, for she was fair to look on. But the queen Vashti refused to come at the king's commandment by his chamberlains. Therefore was the king very wroth, and his anger burned in him. The king said to the wise men, which knew the times, for so was the king's manner towards all that knew law and judgment. And the next unto him was another list of people that with Persian and Median names that I'm not going to try to read off. Seven princes of Persia and Media, which saw the king's face, in which sat the first in the kingdom. What shall we do unto the queen Vashti according to the law, because she has not performed the commandment of the king Ahasuerus by the chamberlains? And Memucan answered before the king and the princes, Vashti the queen has not done wrong to the king only, but also to all the princes and to all the people that are in all the provinces of the king Ahasuerus. For the deed of the queen shall come abroad unto all women, so that they shall despise their husbands in their eyes. And when it shall be reported, the king Ahasuerus commanded Vashti the queen to be brought in before him, but she came not. Likewise shall the ladies of Persian Media say this day unto all the king's princes which have heard of the deeds of the queen, thus shall they arise to much contempt and wrath. So, one of the things that starts the Book of Esther is a bad queen that won't listen to her husband's commands because she's apparently a queen. I must not think that she needs to. And she is going to destroy the family structure in Persia and Media, in the realm of the king. And that the fear of the wise men that know law and judgment are that she's going to create a situation where every woman in the whole country is going to do this. And it's going to destroy the country. It's a pretty wise thought. It also gives some credit to this pagan people, that even they, who seemingly in America today, we can't see that that is the case. That it is a natural thing for men and women to act in this way, that women should not dishonor their husbands, especially publicly. What this leads to is the king, Ahasuerus, divorcing or putting away Ezra. Not Ezra. Vashti. I was going to say Esther, and then I changed and said a completely different biblical character. So he ends up divorcing Vashti and then looking for a new queen. Esther is eventually chosen after looking through all the realm, and they find a beautiful woman. Going into Esther 2, it says in verse 5, now in Shushan the palace there was a certain Jew. Now that should be understood as someone from the house of Judah. Whenever we talk about a Jew, It would have been better if we would have had the word Judean probably translated than the word Jew, which is actually the same word. And in the New Testament, they chose to interchange the two words. But Judean would be accurate. It describes the land that they lived in and the houses that they were divided into. The division of houses after the split of the tribes, when the 10 tribes went to the north and the southern tribes divided off, was Benjamin, Judah, and most of Levi was with the house of Judah. These became known as Judeans in the New Testament, or Jews. Not to be mistaken with those who think that the word Jew means every single Israelite, or some people even would call Abraham a Jew. This is a complete fallacy, and it is ignorant for anybody, no matter how intelligent, including Noah Webster, who would say that that's the case. Anybody should be able to read 1 Kings chapter 17, find the first time Jew is ever used, and go from there to understand it. Abraham was not a Jew, Isaac was not a Jew, Jacob was not a Jew, there was not a Jew until Judah, and even he was never called one. So until he had children, there were no Judahites, ones of Judah. That's important also, which goes along with the genealogy of who these people are. They would have geographically been known as Jews or Judeans because of where they lived, under the house of Judah. They followed David as their king, the seed of David, and they were part of the kingdom of Judah. This is why the new covenant says, I will make a new covenant with the house of Israel and the house of Judah. There are two different houses. Now, in 5 it says, there was a certain Jew or Judean whose name was Mordecai. He was the son of Jer, the son of Shimei, the son of Kish, a Benjamite. So he was of the tribe of Benjamin. He was not even of the tribe of Judah, even though he was considered a Jew. This is because of where he would have previously lived before the captivity, when that division was caused, even before the Assyrian captivity, when the 10 tribes separated from Judah. 6. Who had been carried away from Jerusalem with the captivity, which has been carried away with Jeconiah, king of Judah, whom Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, had carried away. Now notice that how we had read also in Daniel, it says that he had come into the kingdom of the Chaldeans, and the Chaldeans and Babylonians need to be understood as being one kingdom. He brought up Hadassah. This is Esther, his uncle's daughter, for she had neither father nor mother, and the maid was fair and beautiful, whom Mordecai, when her father and mother were dead, took for his own daughter. Now, the Septuagint translation says that he took her to raise her up to be his wife. Which translation, neither one would be an unlawful situation. And this is a type of biblical adoption that was perfectly acceptable under these times. The Septuagint says that he brought her up to be his wife or his woman. Could have meant that he was just simply going to keep her as a handmaid. It could have meant that he actually intended on marrying her at some point. But that was a common thing that you can read in the scriptures and find other incidents of that type of thing happening. But Mordecai was planning on keeping Hadassah or Ezra, regardless of the situation, because she was his kin. It was his obligation. It was his family. Which, just like how we started in the book of Esther, started talking about the destruction of the family, as which Ahasuerus was worried about via his wise men. He's worried about the family structure becoming destroyed, and Vashti having little to no care for the commandment of the king. Whereas Esther, coming from a family where it was incredibly important to take care of their kin, because Esther... So ultimately, Esther, not Ezra, as I keep slipping into saying. Esther came from a strong family where her uncle was willing to raise her up to be his own and to take care of her. These two connections are extremely important. Further on in the story, it says in 17, the king loved Esther above all the women, and she obtained grace and favor in his sight more than all the virgins, so that he set the royal crown upon her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. Then the king made a great feast unto all the princes and his servants, even Esther's feast. And he made a release to the provinces and gave gifts according to the state of the king. So Esther received the grace of the king that the king wanted, or the king was looking for, because of her beauty, it mentions, but it could also be seen that perhaps after examining her, it would be known to him that she had a deeper respect for whoever it is that she would marry, or that her family life was very important, that family was an important thing to her. Twenty says, Esther had not yet showed her kindred nor her people, as Mordecai charged her. For Esther did the commandment of Mordecai, like as when she was brought up with him. In those days, while Mordecai sat in the king's gate, two of the king's chamberlains, Bigthan and Teresh, of those who kept the door, were wroth and sought to lay hands on the king Ahasuerus. And the thing was known to Mordecai, who told it unto Esther, the king thereof, in Mordecai's name. And when inquisition was made of the matter, it was found out. Wherefore, they were both hanged on a tree, and it was written in the book of the Chronicles before the king. And here's where the next interesting situation happens. Mordecai becomes esteemed now, Esther as well, in the sight, and it says that they hadn't showed their people yet. So the king, looking into the matter, whether that means he obviously knew that she was from somewhere in the region, that she was a Jew, so to speak, a Judean, from the captivity of Judah, but maybe didn't look deep into who she was, didn't make a deep inquisition into who her, you know, whether she's of royal blood or not, I think is why they mention that. After these things did King Ahasuerus promote Haman, the son of Hammedatha, who was the Agagite, and advanced him and set his seat above the princes that were with him. All the king's servants that were in the king's gate bowed and reverenced Haman, for the king had so commanded concerning him. But Mordecai bowed not, nor did him reverence. Well, Mordecai was listening to the king, liked the Ahasuerus enough to warn him that someone was going to kill him. Seemingly, Mordecai honored King Ahasuerus for whatever reason, gave him the respect that he deserved as a king. But when this man was set over the kingdom in this way, and was made advanced above all the princes, for some reason Mordecai wouldn't bow to him anymore. He wouldn't listen to that commandment. He said, I'm not bowing to this guy. And the question would ask, why would a seemingly trusting servant that did the king's commandments in times past wouldn't have done that? So he asks. In 3, it says, then the king's servants, which were in the king's gate, said unto Mordecai, why transgressest thou the king's commandment? So this is a breaking of law, public policy. It came to pass that when they spake daily unto him, and he hearkened not unto them, that they told Haman to see whether Mordecai's matter would stand, for he had told them that he was a Jew, or a Judean. And when Haman saw that Mordecai bowed not, nor did him reverence, then was Haman full of wrath. And he thought scorn to lay hands on Mordecai alone, for they had shown him the people of Mordecai. Wherefore Haman sought to destroy all the Judeans, or the Jews, that were throughout the whole kingdom of Assyrus, even the people of Mordecai. So this anger between the two of them is heightening. It starts by Mordecai not bowing to this Agagite. And then it goes further by them wondering, why won't you bow? And he won't speak to them. He kind of like Christ when he's being inquired of. He just doesn't talk. He doesn't answer. He doesn't need to answer, he feels like. Then they go and they tell Haman, who, interestingly enough,